Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Welcome back to the second of a two-part series with Colonel Retired John Antle. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and we'll continue the conversation about the overlap between the imperatives in FM3O and Colonel Retired John Antle's in-depth research and observations regarding today's battlefield. So Colonel Antle is a former armor officer and is passionate about everyone understanding the changing methods of war. Before we dive into three more imperatives, let me reiterate the disruptors on today's battlefield. Mr. Antle's 10 disruptors are transparent battlefield, first strike advantage, AI and the tempo of war, top attack, fully autonomous, cognitive electronic warfare, kill web, super swarm, visualize the battle space, and decision dominance. So we'll discuss these 10 disruptors alongside these three imperatives. The first, make contact with the smallest element possible. Then we'll talk about designate, sustain, and weight the main effort. And finally, we'll talk about consolidate gains continuously. Sir, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Now, I think this first imperative may be much easier said than done. It is make initial contact with the smallest element possible. In the last episode, sir, you were talking about the concept of bots before boots. And I think that's wrapped up into this imperative. What else are you seeing that makes this so important to meet today's military objectives?
Yes. The way we want to do this is we want to have robotic systems be our first contact. All right? So imagine Star Trek. Everyone's watched Star Trek. Let's go to the original Star Trek. What did Captain Kirk do when he wanted to meet the girl on the planet? He would beam down. Never check the planet. Nobody knows if there's any, you know, COVID going on down there. Nobody knows anything. Even he just goes straight. You would never do that, ever. You would send a robot first. You would always send a robot first, okay? Now, in combat, what we've got to do is start using our robots to be there, the tip of the spear, be there first, and give us real-time information and maybe even real-time damage on the enemy. So loitering munitions are very good, because loitering munitions are more high-end, and, you know, like the Switchblade 300 and 600 and others types, and they fly over the battle space, and they continually look down, and when they see a target, they alert the operator, and he says, yes, kill it, and that loitering munition goes straight down and hits the target, unless it's jammed or shot down. So that's a loitering munition. An ISR drone can be any size. And usually these have a range of anywhere between 12 to 20 kilometers, and they go out and search for things. And you could perch them on top of the house or a tree, and they would just watch. So you can get all this real-time information. A bomber drone goes out there with a mine or a grenade or an explosive package, RPG, and it's able to drop that right on the enemy. And one of the best ways to clean up the battlefield after you've disabled enemy tanks and enemy armored vehicles, when a tank crew exits a vehicle, they jump out as fast as they can to save their lives. They don't close the hatch. Nobody closes the hatch. You don't have time. Hatch is open. Bomber drone can fly right over and drop a grenade right down the hatch. If they can't do that, they can drop it on the engine. There's so many ways you can destroy these things when they're disabled and there's nobody protecting them. Then you have FPV drones, which are the main killers, because they're able to see things and they're like racing drones. They go super fast. They see the target and they're able to hit it precisely at the right spot. And that's why you got this guy like the hero of Ukraine who destroyed so much Russian equipment. He was fighting only FPV drones. So we've got all these different systems out there, and that's just the ones that fly. We can also have ground systems to go out there and check for us. And we should have, for instance, a whole series of ground vehicles that are robotic to breach enemy obstacle belts. Our main tactic should always be bots before boots, get them out there flying or hovering or even balloons or on the ground and see the enemy first, strike the enemy first, and we should be fighting them from farther distance. So, for instance, when we finally move in with tanks and combined arms forces, the enemy's mostly destroyed. And what we're doing now is we're getting into what Patton called the happy hunting ground of the enemy, which is their logistics systems, their command and control, and all their key choke points with logistics like rail centers and things like that, where we can destroy. So we have got to rethink combined arms operations. A lot of what we have is very good. Hardly anybody else in the world can do combined arms as well as we can, but we shouldn't rest on those laurels. We need to go higher. We need to get robots totally integrated. And that real-time information to the warfighter who's right there up front, the platoon leader, the squad leader, the company commander, that's critical. And that's the difference between a modern army and doing it in the old way.
You're really making me think about the professionalism in our army. And because we are professionals, you know, we can't be replaced easily. So we need to, you know, to save lives, we need to preserve combat power with our people. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, we cannot afford to lose 40% of our army. Replacing 40% of our army would take how long? Yeah.
Too long.
Right. Too long. And we can't afford that. And the Chinese know that. And if they have a first strike on us in the Pacific, we could be in real trouble. So we have to become harder to kill.
The next imperative that we will talk about today is designate, wait, and sustain the main effort. I think this really is a continuation of the conversation that we already have been having. Could you give other examples of what we can learn from ongoing conflicts?
The interesting thing now is that you must mask your forces in order to be able to mass your forces. You see, if you try to mass your forces and you're not massed, the enemy's long-range precision fires and even their dumb artillery will kill you as soon as you get within range of that. And mostly, they're in range everywhere you are. For instance, the Russians can hit anywhere in Ukraine. And with some of their missiles, they could hit anywhere in Europe. Now, the majority of their stuff is closer range, but that closer range is like 40 kilometers now. So our whole concept of what is safe has got to change. There are no sanctions on the battle space. So with that in mind, emphasizing masking is crucial. Now, how did the Ukrainians, for instance, mask for their attack into Russia? One of the things they did, there's a series of things they did, was a very, very well-planned out holistic effort. They dispersed all their forces into villages and forests, had their guys wear civilian clothes so they didn't even look like soldiers, camouflaged everything, kept it cold, no communications, so that when they were given the order to move, they could rapidly mount vehicles and move out. So that's a great way to hide in assembly areas. So what are we doing in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Poland? We're all clustered together on posts in peacetime configuration, ready to be shot. Okay, so they did that, and then they did some really interesting things. They sent drones forward to find out information. And those drones gave them a lot of good information back. Most of them were all ISR drones. They weren't on the hunt. They were just there to see what was going on. But they also cyber hacked into the security cameras of individual people at their homes. So if you had a ring doorbell, they were able to see that and see how many Russian vehicles went down the road. They were counting Russians by hacking into the electronics of the villages in the Kursk Oblast. And they were able to see that there were hardly any Russians there. And they knew where most of them were. And they had satellite imagery and they had a lot of other stuff from us. And then when they decided to go, they came in and threw an infiltration attack. So you see, you can't mass right now, so infiltration attack is going to become one of the major tactics. If you can totally blind the enemy, you can mass in the old way, but that's going to be hard to do. So you're going to have to infiltration attack. So they basically came in small units, platoons, companies. You see the Russians doing this all the time. They'll come with two tanks, a squad of guys. You know, take a tree line. And then once they do that, they'll reinforce it. But they don't rush 100 guys up because they'll just all get killed. So dispersion and the ability to infiltrate is really important. So they were able to do all that. So to sustain all this, They were also able to get logistics in there, but they didn't launch their logistics in convoys like we do. They launched them in smaller units, very small units. Now, that takes more time, and it also takes better trained people. So what we need to be doing is we need to be thinking about how we do logistics. So, for instance, why don't we have a major effort to make our logistics fly by drone? Why not create a car-sized drone with big enough lift capability where you can put 500 pounds on it or 600 pounds or 1,000 pounds? These are out there. And fly those 3 feet off the ground, 5 feet off the ground, getting over obstacles, getting in quickly, dropping stuff off at cache points and leaving, and then we come pick it up, maybe with another drone and a robot or maybe with humans. But we need to start thinking through how we're going to move this, because if we try to move convoys the way we used to, they will just be destroyed. I mean, they were being destroyed in Afghanistan as it was when we tried to move convoys from Pakistan up, but we weren't as excited because most of it was contractors, okay? But what we've got to do is we've got to think this through. Our logistics systems are based on the old way. They are not dispersed. They are not hardened. They are not distributed. And we've got to figure that out. So to sustain an effort, you've got to be able to do that. The Ukrainians were able to do it. Taking out our wounded. I mean, removing wounded is a huge problem. And our casualty rates are going to be higher in pure fighting than anything we've experienced in the last 20, 30 years. So if you lose 50 guys in a day, how are you going to get them out, 50 wounded? You can't get them out in the day because the day gives the enemy more ways to kill you. So you're going to have to move them at night. You won't be able to helicopter them out. Helicopters will be destroyed. Helicopters will never get forward of the main battle line. The idea that we're going to have deep helicopter operations is quite a fantasy until we've destroyed almost all the enemy. So as much as I love our air mobile folks and our helicopters, we've got to change that doctrine real fast because it's not working anywhere in the world right now. And I don't know what it will take for us to figure it out except for a major disaster. Because everybody has shoulder-fired air defense weapon systems. And now even drones can attack helicopters. And there's been many situations in Ukraine where a couple of them where Ukrainian drones have knocked down or disabled or chased away Russian helicopters. So what we've got to do is we've got to figure out how to get our wounded out. Again, we need a robotic flying system that can go hover 3 feet, 4 feet off the ground, put two wounded in there or one wounded guy, and then get him back to some kind of casualty evacuation center and then back to treatment. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a lot of wounded being given immediate first aid and then dying in place. We also need to figure out how to change the golden hour, which is the most important thing, stop the bleeding and get that person who's wounded into a situation where they might survive. We've got to change the golden hour to a golden day. We need to figure out how to put basically a human in stasis for a while. Difficult medical challenge, but something we should be pushing for. Are we asking this question? Are we asking the medical community what could we do? And if we're not, what are we waiting for? So our whole concept of supporting a main effort and keeping it going, you know, requires not only the shifting of forces that are difficult to mass in a transparent battle space and have to be have to be carefully considered and all that, but also the logistics of how you support that.
The last imperative that we'll cover today is consolidate gains continuously. I usually think about this imperative in terms of tempo and accepting risk to bypass enemy forces. However, the doctrine authors also wanted us to consider the human and information domain. So, you know, changing behaviors, countering mis and disinformation, those kinds of things. So what are your thoughts, sir, on how this imperative fits into the context of recent conflicts?
Yeah, these case studies of the last five major conflicts since 2020 show you the value of the information war and how you can win the information war
And that becomes icing on the cake of your victory and maybe even helps you make into a tipping point to make that victory. It won't win the war by itself unless you're up against a totally demoralized enemy. But for instance, in the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War, the drone strikes and the long-range precision missile strikes that the Azerbaijanis launched on the Armenians were shown on social media every night. And the mothers and fathers of Armenian soldiers were scanning those videos every night looking to see if their son had been killed. Well, that was demoralizing because all they saw was Armenian soldiers dying over and over and over again and no strike back. One Armenian soldier said this, it's frightening. And think about it. We don't want to ever be in this situation, but this is what he said. There was no place to hide and no way to run. Transparent battle space, precision weaponry. Mm-hmm. No place to hide and nowhere to run. So using that for the information war and putting all that on social media and other means was something that is a case study that Azerbaijan did very effectively against Armenia. It also helped deter Russia, which was interesting because Russia, of course, was an ally of Armenia, but didn't do anything because they want the oil from Azerbaijan. So they were playing both sides. But the other wars also involve info war information pieces. The 2021 Israeli-Hamas war became info piece for the Israelis to say, hey, see how good we are? We can beat them in 11 days. Now, unfortunately for the Israelis, that hubris, much like our hubris could be, blinded them to possibilities that happened in 2023.
Uh-huh.
Because they were absolutely shocked that their high-tech wall could be overcome. And even though they hardly had any forces there to defend it, how rapidly the enemy could mass and break through without using cell phones. I mean, there were cell phone usage, but the Israelis had keyed on their command and control system being primarily run by radio and cell phone. And this, of course, was operated primarily out of voice at an initial order and very little comms, even though there were some indicators, the Israelis didn't believe it. So you only have to fool the enemy, key decision leaders. For instance, on D-Day, we only had to fool Hitler. If Hitler didn't believe that we were going to attack in Normandy, but thought for sure we were going to attack at the Pas-de-Calais, that's all we needed because he was going to tell people what to do and nobody else could do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So against dictatorships, those are the kind of things you have to look at. So how do we use information operations to our advantage? This is a open field that we can really get into and should be doing a lot of thought experiments on because what we can provide against an enemy population, but particularly against a enemy decision maker, is crucial. And what they see on our news and what they see through our open source media will be very important because they mine our stuff all the time. I mean, it's difficult sometimes to peer back into China and see what their military is doing. You can do it on open source intelligence. And we have other means that are not open source that are secret that I'm sure we can do much, much better. I hope we can do much better. But you can find out a lot with open source. So imagine our society that is open, not like the Chinese, they can see a lot there. So we have to think all that through. You know, if we went to major war against a peer competitor, would we do what we did in World War II, which is massive censorship? In World War II, you couldn't even show an American soldier dead until 1943. A still picture. So, you know, what would we do? And are we ready for that? Do we understand that? And how would we do it?
You know, so that information piece reminds me of an episode we had on Russian threat doctrine. And in that episode, we talked about how differently Russia views information, how differently they use information. And I say that differently than how we use information, view information. So I think that piece about understanding your enemy is just so, so important.
Yes. In fact, one of our challenges right now is that our leaders are not studying the enemy. Some are, of course, but too many are not. I know because I talk to them. You know, Tell me about the Chinese army. What do you know about the Chinese army? Blank faces. What do you know about the Russian army? Oh, they're not very good. Look at how they're getting beat up in Ukraine. Okay, that's fine, but tell me about how they fight. Or at least how they're fighting now. Or what about a case study that you just studied from the Russo-Ukrainian war that happened this summer? We're just not doing that professional level of study that we should. And some people say, that's not my job. I've got a job to do every day. I don't have time to study. I had a general officer told me he was in command. He didn't have time to study war. No kidding. I didn't know what to say. I was shocked. We have got to study these wars. And if we're not, who is? The civilians expect us to. The government leaders expect us to. And it shouldn't be that we leave it up to somebody else. It's up to you. It's up to each one of us. So if you don't know anything about the Chinese army, the Russian army, the North Korean army, or the Iranian army, at least start in your area. So be prepared to fight against your major enemy. Now, if God forbid all of our enemies attack us all at once, you know, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians and all their proxies, you know, and the North Koreans attack us all at once, that will be Dragon Day. That will be a really bad day. That Dragon Day is something that I worry about, but we can change that with good deterrence, which requires leadership and being much harder to kill. So we've got to think through all this. Again, if you look at most of our camps, posts, and stations in areas that can be hit, like Korea, they're in peacetime configuration. And no one's going to change that because they don't want to say that we're going to raise the threat level. And that is garbage. We have got to be harder and smarter than that. We've got to say no. You know, it might be smart to have some bunkers. It might be good to have a plan. If we had 10 minutes warning, what we would do to save personnel. Mm-hmm. It might be good to have a plan. What happens if they struck us tomorrow? I mean, if we were going to disperse forces, how fast can we disperse them? And of course, if we haven't thought through this, then we're negligent. So I believe we have, but we need to do more work there. And we need to build the structures and the capabilities to keep us, make us harder to kill. And there's a lot of things we can do in the multi-domain operations business. If you want to dig in, you need picks and shovels. So how many picks and shovels do you have in the brigade? They didn't know. They have some in their BII, which is with every vehicle. But that's not enough. So if you want to dig in a command post, you either get bulldozers and engineer equipment, which is scarce. How much of that will you get? Well, you better start digging in. The Ukrainians, for instance, they're infantry units. Are well-trained, they will come to a place where has nothing, and they'll have trenches there in 24 hours. They'll be hard to kill in 24 hours, harder to kill. Now, it doesn't mean you can't be killed, and I'm not suggesting that trench warfare is the future of everything. So we've got to think through the protection piece. We've got to start doing as best we can to mask our forces, understand and embrace masking, and we need to do the hard work that leaders need to make happen through discipline. And I had one leader tell me, well, we don't make them dig in because it's hard. Oh. Right. Think about it. So there are very few leaders that say they've made their guys dig in. And this is pictures of it. I briefed the British Army, an artillery, Royal Artillery Unit. And I told them all about this and they just looked at me blank faced and said, wow, I think you're right. 8 months later, they went back to their training area and they showed me the trenches in the bunkers that they'd built. They'd never done it before and they learned an awful lot. And I thought, outstanding, well done. But that's the British Army. You know, they're a little closer to the Ukrainian fight. We've got to think this through. So we've got to have the skill set and the discipline and the leadership to make it happen.
Before we wrap up, I have one last question. You know, I think, sir, that you have absolutely shown an urgency, urgency for us to transform, urgency to be innovative, and, you know, urgency to really lead. So what do you see in the U.S. Army that's holding us back or preventing a sense of urgency within some formations?
Well, that's an easy answer. Leadership. You see, leadership changes everything. So if anything's holding you back, it's leadership. Now, people will make excuses. They'll say the budget, you know, supplies, things like this. Leadership overcomes those things. I can show you, for instance, right before World War II, 1940, General George Marshall was put in charge of the U.S. military. What did he do? He fired most of the two stars and above. Now, that's shocking. That was a purge. That was the greatest purge in American history, by the way, when Marshall fired so many leaders because they were thinking in the old way, in World War I way, and they weren't thinking in the new way. And as an example, in 1940, Eisenhower was lieutenant colonel. In 1944, he was a four-star general. Mm-hmm. So how the hell did that happen? Because all those other guys were gone. All those other guys were gone. And they were gone on purpose because their thinking would have got us killed. Just imagine if, you know, a World War I thinking general had launched us from England into the Pas-de-Calais, and we had fought a trench war for 4 years, you know, in northern France. That's the kind of thinking we couldn't afford. And we had all sorts of new weapon systems and ideas that had to be integrated. It took leaders. Now, it doesn't matter what age you are and what rank you are. We need leaders. So if you want to solve problems, leadership solves problems. Leadership provides foresight, the ability to solve problems in the short term and create solutions for the long run. We desperately need leaders across the board.
Thanks, sir, for your insights, for your giving us all a sense of urgency. Appreciate your time today.
I think the urgency need is very real. We can't put it off. We can't say it's going to be fixed in 2030 or 2040. We have to be able to fight tonight. We have to be able to react to the war that happens tomorrow. Our enemies will not give us warning. They will not want a fair fight. They will be unfair, dastardly, and they will come at us with everything they've got. And one thing they learned from the Ukrainian war is that a first strike, like the Russians did against the Ukrainians, their first strike wasn't very good. They only hit 2,119 targets in the first week. That's horrible. Russia should have used everything they had and completely smashed Ukraine if they wanted to come in the way they were going to do. And that's what the Chinese learned. They learned that if they do a first strike, it has to be all in. And the North Koreans saw the same thing. So with those two things in mind, we have a lot to get ready for to be able to fight tonight.
Thanks for joining us on the show today, sir.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
Thanks, sir.
All right. God bless America and God bless our Army. Booah.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.